do like Dawah Islamic content, and alhamdulillah, even though I have less like views, the hasanat is a lot greater in the akhirah, inshallah.
Joining us today to talk about Islam, Muslims and social media, we have two esteemed guests. Paul Williams runs the Blogging Theology social media platform, which has hundreds of thousands of followers. Blogging Theology features a regular cast of high-profile guests discussing Islam mostly, but also other Abrahamic faiths too. And Noor Fekri is a business owner and politics graduate with a keen interest in the Middle East. She has successfully used social media to shine a light on religious and political events in a way that is easily accessible to the everyday person. Welcome to the show, both of you. Paul, you've been on the show before, so I'll come straight to you. Nice to have you back, of course. But just tell me, obviously, you've been on social media a while now. You're quite a well-established brand, especially here in the UK. Tell me about your experience. How have you found it navigating the world of social media?
I think overwhelmingly it's been very positive for me, actually. And in a sense, I'm glad I've come to social media later in life, because I bring kind of experience from the real world into social media. So I try and avoid obvious pitfalls like getting into arguments or being ticked. So I try and focus on what I do, and I try and do what I do better each day, and rather than getting involved in disputes and arguments, which I have done in the past, mainly at Speaker's Corner, but online, no, I focus on the work, and alhamdulillah, blessing from God, it's been a very good experience so far.
But surely you've come across some of the negative aspects, yeah. The fact that even if you avoid the toxic, like the debates, the arguments, that type of thing, I mean, the fact that you have a large following now, people look to you for information and for knowledge, and they enjoy your content, they'll probably pay you quite a regular bunch of compliments, I dare say, Paul. How have you handled that? Do you think it's changed you in any way?
Yes, that's a very good point, because there can be problems to do with success rather than just bad experiences. So I have had a lot of praise, and that is difficult to deal with. I find it difficult to deal with, because that's a test for me in terms of the challenges to be arrogant or egotistical. So I'm very conscious where the blessing has come from, and I try and always remember that comes from God. And also it could disappear at any moment. You know, the plug could be pulled on the channel, or I could get run over by a bus or something. So I'm aware that it's provisional, but it's a blessing. And also it's a service. What I do now much more as a service to the ummah rather than an extension of a personal hobby, which is what it was originally. You know, I find this interesting, I'll just do something about it. Now I'm aware that it has that kind of service dimension to it.
Noor, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on, first time appearance. Now, just tell me about your experience on social media, because I like the fact that obviously you're young. You're also a sister as well. So your experience is probably quite different to, say, mine or Paul's, who we're used to. I mean, when I first came on social media, it was MySpace. I don't know if you even remember MySpace, MSN, and now it's changed quite a lot to the point where we have TikTok now, brand new platforms, which are a new challenge, which I know you're on as well. Just tell me, what's your experience been like?
So I think my experience is very interesting. I sort of fell into posting videos on social media. It wasn't out of choice. It was more like during my pilgrimage to for the Edinburgh, during the Edinburgh pilgrimage, I posted a video about my journey, and that sort of went viral. And I think that's what's interesting about TikTok and makes it so different to all the other platforms, is that the algorithm sort of works a little bit differently, and you can go viral quite easily. Mm. And once I gained that following, I think around 20,000 followers, albeit in Baghdad or wherever, but you know, that I then realized that, you know, the power of that and being able to push sort of positive content in terms of my political activism, and I saw that as a, you know, a fantastic opportunity. So actually my experience has been very positive. I do I think it's a little bit different as a woman posting content on social media. You don't necessarily get the compliments that you might get. Instead, you have people asking you to sort of take down your videos, and that, you know, women shouldn't be involved in sort of outward political activism and sort of showing your face. You know, women can sort of use other platforms like writing. But I think it's really important for us to utilise the tools that we have at our disposal, which, you know, in this day and age is TikTok, is Instagram Reels, and in terms of me being a woman and sort of showing my face, I mean, I believe that it is everyone's Islamic duty to be involved in some sort of social and political activism. I don't think it should be limited in terms of me being a woman.
You've said some really interesting stuff there, and what also interested me is what one of the other sisters out in the streets of London mentioned. She said that she went very viral. Mm-hmm. She was getting millions of views, loads of followers. I think it was on TikTok, I can't remember. But she also said that she started to experience depression. She felt like she was chasing the creation rather than the creator. So she became addicted to getting those views, going viral. She was doing pranks on her parents. I think she was from an Arab background, and that's not traditional. To prank your parents is a bit disrespectful, maybe. But I don't know. Maybe I'm going too far there. But those seem to be challenges. She was initially interested in going viral. Then it started to have a negative effect on her personality, on her life. How would you respond to that?
I mean, it's a shame that she had to experience that. But it's really easy to fall into those traps, and it's really important for us as Muslims to be aware of that, and be aware that these social media platforms, you know, firstly understand who owns these platforms. So, for example, with Twitter, it's, you know, quite recently Elon Musk, and we've got Facebook and Instagram by Mark Zuckerberg. These are all Western either companies or individuals, so they'll have a particular agenda that they're trying to, you know, being on these social media platforms in and of itself is a challenge for us Muslims. So you're entering essentially the enemy's territory. That is their territory. You're entering it. You need to understand how to navigate it and not fall into the traps of sort of, you know, this influencer culture whereby you're entirely consumed by, I don't know, these hijabi influencers that will teach you sort of how to dress modestly whilst simultaneously being modest. It's really important not to fall into that trap.
I'm going to come back to you, Nob. I want to get Paul before we go on to the next part of the show. Paul, I wouldn't be going into an environment which is like a drinking environment, like a pub, for example. You wouldn't see me walking into a pub anymore because obviously I know that there'll be haram activities going on in there. I'll be in an environment which perhaps I'll be tempted to do something which Islam doesn't condone. So I won't go there. I'll make the right decision and not bother going there. With social media, however, it seems as if people are making the decision to go in, knowing that they're going to see haram stuff. They're doing it anyway, and then they try to justify it by saying, well, no, actually, I'm doing something good for Islam. How can that be justified, Paul?
I think it can be justified. I mean, it's an online public square. So it's not like a pub where you have to specifically go to a specific building. I think, as I say, social media is like an online version of the world, and a lot of us inhabit that. So there's a lot of good online, and a lot of evil online, a lot of other just rubbish online as well. And what I try and do, I try and keep my head down and focus as much as I can, by the grace of God, on producing good content.
It's a bit hard not to do a bit of side-eyeing, though. The zombie scrolling feature, something could pop
zombie scrolling is just leaves me dead. I mean, pun intended. I mean, you know, 5 seconds and I'm bored. You know, I rush off and grab a book because I'm a bit addicted to books. My addiction, by the way, is not to TikTok, it's to books. And, you know, like I breathe and eat, I have to read. It's just who I am. So I have a different kind of addiction.
To add to this discussion, we spoke with another prominent Muslim social media content producer known by his digital name, That Muslim Guy. That Muslim Guy has gone viral multiple times for his content challenging the anti-Muslim stereotypes routinely peddled by mainstream media. Here's what he had to say on the subject.
So far, I've been on social media for approximately 6 years or so, and it is a mixed bag. Of course, as with everything, social media is a very powerful tool, and I compare it to being the printing press of our day and age. And it's like any other tool, any other technology. It's all about how you use it. It could be used to cause good, could be used to cause harm. And for it's been a net positive, but it has come with a lot of challenges, and we have to learn how to manage the challenges and put controls in place in order to turn it into a net positive and not fall victim to the many cons that are associated with social media. So just to be clear, whenever we talk about addiction is anything that essentially it's very difficult to stop. It's impacting your life in a negative manner, maybe those around you. And social media is definitely an addiction, whether we like to admit it or not. At the end of the day, no matter how much we try to keep our youth away from social media, like Instagram and Facebook, although youth aren't really using Facebook as much, Instagram, TikTok, no matter what we do, they're going to go to school, they're going to go to work, they're going to go to university, they're going to go wherever, see their friends. And they'll be exposed to it. So the best we could do is to ensure that we educate the youth, our children, the next generation, as to the pros and the cons of media. And there are many dangers. There are pros, but there are many dangers. So the key is education, giving them an Islamic education. Know that there is a lot of haram on these social media platforms. At what age do you allow them to use social media? Now that comes down to the individual parents. Personally, I say the youth are on there anyways. And if we do not go on there as well to counter that narrative, that agenda, whether it's the nudity, whether it's the sexual content, whether it's the Islamophobia being spread on those platforms. If we don't have a presence there, then we can't reclaim the narrative in any way, shape, or form. And the youth that's already on there and we can't do anything about it, they're just going to be exposed to all that negativity and non-activity. So at the very end of the day, it comes down to your individual intentions, of course, but if you want to do da'wah, you have to use the printing press of today's day and age. Personally, I think this can be divided into two main things. There's the people who achieve great success, and they get all the likes, all the engagements and everything, and then that becomes an addiction, and you want more of it. So then you start off initially talking about Islamic content, and the intentions are righteous, and then you fall victim to this, I need more likes, I need more views, and you start going down that path, essentially, whereby it's just about the views at this point, doesn't matter what I talk about, and you unfortunately move away from your deen, and you fall into depression, and you fall victim to that lifestyle. Then there's the other end of the spectrum, and that's when you're not getting the views. There's no instant fame. It's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years of hard work, you're grinding, and nothing, 20 views, 50 views, 3 likes. What am I even doing this for? And then that's a struggle in and of itself, and you also fall into some sort of depression there. Is this even worth it? So the point becomes, go back to your intentions, and the results are with Allah. And the main thing I can compare that to is, look at prophets and messengers, like Nuh alayhi salam, Prophet Noah, peace be upon him. How many years, 950 years, he preached to his people, and how many followers did he have? Scholars differ on the number, but it's very, very little. Does that mean he wasn't a great prophet? Does that mean he didn't work as hard as he can to preach his people? No. We control our work, our intention. Allah controls the results. So always remember your intention when you are experiencing either this fame or this seemingly you're not going anywhere. And what's the point?
Well, you've heard from Muhammad there, and let's come back to our discussion in the studio. Now, Noor, I'm going to come back to you because I want to tell you very briefly a story which I saw very recently on social media. It happened on Twitter. There was a sister who posted an Eid Day celebration picture of herself. Now, I didn't see the picture. I think that she was young, good-looking sister, mashallah, and unfortunately, she began to get trolled. She was trolled routinely. There was inappropriate comments being made by non-Muslims about her. The picture went viral. Then she started getting attacked from Muslims who were like, how dare she put a picture up? Look what's happened. She's now being shamed and embarrassed and disgraced. She then ended up deleting her profile, deleting the picture. She's now disappeared from social media completely. I assume that's she's had an awful experience. I can only imagine. Yeah. So that's an example of where social media has gone wrong, very badly wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a risk that even you're making, surely, by just being on there. Mm-hmm. A day could come where something happens which puts you in the spotlight, you could go viral for something negative, mm-hmm. you could say something wrong, and then there you go, you're in trouble. So just tell me, how again, do you feel that we as Muslims, Muslim sisters, can handle this type of danger?
I think we need to be really calculated in our approach. So when we're entering these spaces, again, like I said, we're entering the enemy's territory. So, you know, not posting just any random content, not falling into the traps of posting images, you know, to feed into that sort of capitalist ideology, you know. We had numerous sort of hijabi influencers that were, the algorithm would push them so far and it would get so many followers for sort of, you know, promoting hijabi modest streetwear. And then they proceeded to remove the hijab, you know, a couple of years later. And in turn, a lot of women then also removed their hijab.
Do you think that was social media that led them to that decision? Would you blame social media for that?
Yeah, I mean, there was an obvious trend. There was an obvious wave of these social media influencers removing their hijab all at the same time. Mm. So I do believe that social media had a massive role to play in that. But also, it's interesting because there's a massive double standard here. So the West will sort of push that kind of content whilst at the same time demonizing Muslims on, for example, mainstream media outlets.
So this is what I would say then, potentially. I could say that social media is not a safe space for my daughters. It's not a safe space for you. You shouldn't mm-hmm. be on there. You could get drawn into a negative worldview. You could end up removing your hijab. Yeah. What would you say to that?
So I would say that, unfortunately, this is our reality. So we, as Muslims, we shouldn't sort of run away from our reality. Social media is the reality now. Mm-hmm. And there's no use in us sort of hiding away and sort of trying not to be involved in this reality. Instead, we should try and utilise the tools at our disposal to try and to be a force for good on social media, rather than sort of shying away from being involved out of fear. You know, and whether we like it or not, we have to be involved. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of sort of as well establishing putting in guidelines as to how we should be involved, and sort of educating each other within our communities, and also recognizing talent within our communities. We've some people that sort of can put together a fantastic essay within 20 minutes, and then you've got others that can articulate themselves really well in a 1 minute TikTok video, and being able to sort of support each other into the right avenues, and also not really idealizing a particular person, like a particular activist, and making them a celebrity, so that when they do get attacked or taken down or deplatformed or silenced, that the whole movement stops. Instead, we should mobilise and sort of do, you know, it should be a movement that is done all together.
That is a very good point you mentioned. I'm going to throw that at Paul, actually. The fact that there are big egos now that are built up. I'll admit, I'm a bit of an addict. I'm a social media addict. I'm not afraid to say it. I'm on Twitter all the time. I'm even on TikTok and YouTube. You know, it's hard not to be these days, as I think Noor mentioned in her point. But it's very difficult not to become a bit of a narcissist. Obviously, I'll be receiving compliments. My ego's going to grow. I'm going to get a big head from all this. And I think that there is a legitimate issue here of people going online with good intentions, maybe doing a bit of dawah activism, that type of thing, and then all of a sudden they become these big personalities. They're like celebrities. They get treated differently. They start to act differently. I've seen this happen many, many times. Tell me, Paul, how dangerous is this?
It's a real danger. The Quran talks about life being a test, and there are different kinds of tests, and this is a test for us who are on social media, who achieve some measure of success, and that is how to deal with that in terms of vanity and egotism and so on. And absolutely, I'm acutely aware of that, and I have a little motto on my screen, but it partly involves, you know, remembering to be humble, remembering where success comes from, remember where my money comes from, where everything comes from. It's not coming out of my own cleverness. It's a gift from God. It's all from God. So it's a challenge to being Muslim, actually, a good Muslim.
It is a challenge, but what worries me is that there are a lot of people online now that are doing dawah. They're trying to represent Islam, and they're self-styling themselves as ambassadors for the religion. And we don't know where these people have been educated. We don't know if they're qualified to do so. They start lecturing others on how to behave them. Sometimes it turns out that they're not behaving as they lecture people in their own private lives. So do you think that perhaps some of this activism online is actually doing more damage than
absolutely
good?
There's an awful lot of toxic egotism going on. I think I can only say is find reliable sources of information, reliable scholars or reputable people like Hamza Zoltzer, so I can drop names, and Sapiens Institute. Follow reliable, acknowledged people who've got a track record of being mainstream normative Muslims, and follow them, and follow their advice about what books to read and who else to listen to. So don't go running off on your own, and, you know, follow the mainstream and look to the mainstream scholars and people like Hamza Zoltzer. I don't think you'll go wrong then.
Noor, I want to ask you a bit about challenges the Muslims will find, not just for themselves dealing with the platform, but also the fact that there's like a lot of Islamophobic content out there. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that there's a lot of anti-Muslim stories that will go much more viral, be shared a lot more than, say, positive stories about Muslims. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I guess you could argue that Muslims need to be online to combat this anti-Muslim trend. But do you think that it's actually an effective way of fighting back?
I do think it is an effective way of fighting back. I mean, if we compare it to previously, we only sort of had mainstream media outlets, and that was the only option available. Whereas now social media can kind of be seen as a more level ground, and we can all engage, and we can all have a platform, albeit, of course, with, you know, it despite it being owned by Western sort of either companies or individuals, when they're always going to have the upper hand. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage in these platforms altogether. I mean, we've seen some real tangible change on the ground happening through these social media. sort of campaigns. We've had the safe Sheikh Jarrah campaign that happened, for example, whereby there was a Twitter storm and everyone sort of contributed to that. And although, I mean, and at the time the expulsions were halted, and although that might not be the, you know, a huge political event, it's not like we liberated Palestine, for example, but you can see how that can actually, you know, our involvement in social media can actually have real tangible change on the ground. And as well, like I said, there's a massive double standard in that, you know, they'll push content that just sort of feeds into that capitalist ideology, whereas, you know, they'll demonize Muslims on mainstream media and sort of, you know, show us images of terrorists and ISIS and sort of associate that with Muslims to try and dehumanize them and then justify, you know, invading their countries, for example. It's a tool at our disposal that we should be making use of without falling into the traps.
I know from my own personal experience that I tend not to look at the views. You know, I think people get obsessed with views, they make clickbait content, they start to get accused of acting a certain way because they're trying to get people to watch. I just produce it. Do I like it?
Yes.
That's good enough for me.
Don't
look at the views, just post your content. If you've got something interesting to say, put it out there.
Exactly.
That's it. Just don't focus on that.
Exactly.
And hopefully you'll have a better experience, inshallah. Well, thank you very much to both of you. But unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you to our guests. And for you at home, join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Shares of U.S. regional banks PacWest Bancorp and Western Alliance Bank plunged on Tuesday, 2nd of May, as the demise of the First Republic Bank triggered investor concerns about the financial health of other mid-sized lenders. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. JP Morgan Chase's move to acquire most of First Republic Bank's assets this week hasn't stemmed investor concerns about the financial prospects for other regional lenders. The stock prices of Comerica, PacWest Bancorp, Western Alliance Bank, and Zions Bank shares fell sharply on Tuesday, 2nd of May, as attention shifted to other financial players that could be at risk of the startling bank runs that have taken down the First Republic, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank in recent weeks. Wall Street is quickly hitting the sell button as banking turmoil appears it is not going away anytime soon and is ready to focus on the next weakest link, potentially distressed lenders with tremendous exposure to commercial real estate. Edward Moyer, a senior market analyst at Oanda, said in a research note. Shares of Los Angeles-based PacWest with $44 billion in assets plunged 28%, while Western Alliance Bank, with total assets of $65 billion, their shares tumbled 15%. The KBW Regional Bank Index fell 5.5% on the day and is down 28% this year. The sell-off comes just one day after JP Morgan Chase won a government bid to take over most of the assets of First Republic Bank, which was seized by bank regulators as part of the deal. JP Morgan Chase's Chief Executive Officer Jamie Dimon said on Monday that the emergency deal would help stabilize the banking industry while warning that the turmoil affecting mid-size and small lenders could continue. Investors aren't withdrawing from PacWest and Western Alliance Bank for the same reasons they ditched Silicon Valley Bank, said Adam Crisafulli, an analyst at Vital Knowledge. In March, customers pulled their money out because of concerns the banks could be on the hook for hefty losses, Crisafulli said in a research note. That is not spurring the selling now, he said. Instead, the anxiety today is more philosophical, with people asking, why do you exist, with regards to many regional banks? For some investors, regional banks are becoming akin to stodgy brick-and-mortar retailers focused on selling non-perishable commodity products, Crisafulli added. Regional bank lenders say they've become collateral damage to Silicon Valley Bank's failure, but some banks showed signs of stress even before Silicon Valley Bank's collapse. PacWest Bancorp saw its deposits fall by $5.7 billion between January and March of this year. Kevin Thompson, the chief financial officer, said in an earnings call last week, Western Alliance Bank, which also posted earnings last week, reported $3.3 billion in deposit outflows. Despite the recent bank failures, officials from the U.S. Treasury Department, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Biden administration have repeatedly expressed confidence in the stability of the broader banking system in America. Yet investors have increasingly shunned banks that, like Silicon Valley Bank, have large amounts of uninsured deposits, accounts holding more than the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's $250,000 deposit insurance limit. Some banks have also been wrong-footed by rising interest rates, which have raised their costs at the same time that depositors have withdrawn funds in search of high-returning investments. The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Shares of U.S. regional banks PacWest Bank Corporation and Western Alliance Bank plunged on Tuesday, 2nd of May, as the demise of First Republic Bank triggered investor concerns about the financial health of other mid-sized lenders in the United States. J.P. Morgan Chase agreed on Monday to acquire a majority of First Republic Bank's assets, in a $10.6 billion deal after regulators seized the lender, which became the largest U.S. bank failure since the 2008 financial crisis. Investors feared the latest turmoil, which began with the failures of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in March, could spread to other regional banks in the U.S. The KBW Regional Banking Index fell to 5.5%, hitting its lowest level since December of 2020. If a confidence crisis can happen to First Republic Bank, it can happen to any bank in this country, said Jake Dollarhide, the chief executive officer of Longbow Asset Management. This is a potentially a big deal, which hopefully won't materialize to anything significant, he added. The shares of Los Angeles-based PacWest Bancorp tumbled by more than 27%. It is ranked 53rd among U.S. lenders, with $41.2 billion in assets as of the end of last year, according to the Federal Reserve data. The shares of Phoenix, Arizona-based lender Western Alliance, the number 40 U.S. bank with $68 billion in assets, sank 15%, while Cleveland, Ohio-based KeyCorp, the 20th largest bank in the U.S. with $188 billion in assets, fell 9%. Comerica, a Dallas, Texas-based bank, ranked 37th in the United States, the 37th lender with $86 billion in assets, fell by as much as 12%. Shares in Columbus, Georgia-based Synovus Financial Corporation, with $60 billion in assets and ranked 42nd in the United States, lost nearly 7%. Valley National Bank Corp., which owns Valley National Bank based in Passaic, New Jersey, and is the 43rd largest lender in the United States with $57 billion in assets, closed 3% lower after shedding more than 20% of its value on Monday. Historically, once you see a resolution of one institution, the market tends to go after who they view as the next weakest link, said Goldman Sachs regional banks analyst Ryan Nash. The exposure of regional banks to the commercial real estate sector, particularly office buildings that currently have high vacancy rates, has further heightened investor concerns that loan losses could pile up and exacerbate the current crisis amid rising interest rates. Regional banks with up to $250 billion in assets held about $1.1 trillion of commercial real estate loans, with maturities through to 2027 as of the end of last year, according to real estate data analytics firm Trepp Inc. There could be some haircuts on office loans, and that's a market where regional banks have a lot of exposure, Ryan Nash said. JP Morgan Chase's deal for First Republic's assets has ended risk of a contagion, some analysts say. But others noted the deal makes the biggest U.S. bank even bigger, raising the risk of a heightened too-big-to-fail problem that regulators have been trying to solve for years. While we think this deal underscores all of JP Morgan Chase's key strengths, we can't help but try to read into what it means if our biggest bank is the government's first line of defense, analysts at Evercore ISI wrote in a note. The U.S. Federal Reserve is expected to comment on the regional bank crisis at the end of its Federal Open Markets Committee meeting on Wednesday, with markets expecting a 25 basis point hike in the interest rates. The sell-off was driven by the threat of a higher interest rates making the situation even worse, said Phil Bancato, the chief executive officer of Ladenburg Thalmann Asset Management.
Thank you. aperture.
Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten. But the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Shir Muhammad Rahul. To get to Sham-e-Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Shir Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin, who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran, And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible and to many unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Guadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khure Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khur or firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khure Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Guadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilag. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hotags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bakhsh is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bakhsh. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment. A place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I too am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is under pressure after dire Tory losses in local elections. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has called the results disappointing, while the opposition Labour Party says it's on track to win power at the next general election. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faced devastating losses of more than 1,000 Tory seats in local elections, while the opposition Labour Party has said the party is on track to win power at the next general election. The Prime Minister conceded on Friday the English Council results were disappointing, but faced a scathing verdict from some of his MPs and the first rumblings of a threat to his leadership. Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, was buoyed up by winning more than 500 seats, with the party believing its projected vote share puts it on course to take power in the next general election in 2024. The BBC projected national share of the vote put Labour on 35%, the Conservatives on 26%, and Liberal Democrats on 20%, while other parties were on 19%, with estimates extrapolated from the England-only local results. On Friday night, Labour was expecting this to be its best local election result since 1997, with an equivalent vote share lead of 8-9% over the Conservatives. Labour sources said this could result in a majority Starmer government if repeated in a general election. Labour made significant gains from the Conservatives in the north of England and in the Midlands, as well as taking southern councils such as Plymouth, Swindon, Dover and Medway. They celebrated becoming the largest party in local government, which has not happened since the days of Tony Blair in 2002. The party had made surprising successes in Hartsmere in Hertfordshire, the seat of the Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden, where the Tories lost overall control of the local council. With the dire results rolling in through the course of Friday, the Tories had lost more than 1,000 council seats by the